board members, the hunt and staff, and the public. Welcome to the May 13th, 2025 regular meeting of the Lahontan Region Water Quality Control Board. My name is Esther Mustafavi, and I'm board chair. I want to thank you for joining us. We welcome your comments, ideas, and participation because they help us do a better job. Today's board meeting is being conducted in person from South Lake Tahoe, Victorville, and via Zoom. AGP Video is hosting our board meeting. If you're in the Zoom platform, please mute your microphone until you're called upon to speak. At this time, I'd like to introduce other board members of the regional board. From our Victorville office, Rick Deaver from Crestline.
Good morning.
And here in South Lake Tahoe, Jeff Lux from Truckee.
Good morning.
Kimberly Cox from Hellendale.
Good morning.
Rob Pierce from what I now know is pronounced Chalfont.
Good morning.
Amy Horn from Truckee.
Good morning.
Our executive board staff are here today in South Lake Tahoe, including our acting executive officer, Ben Letton, our legal counsel, Elizabeth Barrett, our board clerk, Katrina Fleshman, and our assistant board clerk, Jasmine Enerson. We will later be joined by other staff members for individual agenda items. For those who are present and wish to speak on an agenda item, please fill out the orange card in the back of the room and hand the card to Katrina Fleshman if you're in the South Lake Tahoe office, or Ariel LaFarga if you're in the Victorville office. In addition, we're receiving presentations and public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment via Zoom, you should have submitted a virtual speaking card to our board clerk, Katrina Fleshman, and be in the Zoom meeting platform. If you're interested in commenting via Zoom, please contact our board clerk promptly at katrina.fleshman@waterboards.ca.gov. This meeting is being webcast and recorded, so please speak clearly. For those joining us via Zoom, your camera will be turned off and you'll be muted until it's your turn to speak. When you're done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you'll be placed on mute again. For those who only want to listen to or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. With that, we'll go to our first item, public forum. Any person may address the water board regarding a matter within the water board's jurisdiction that is not related to an item on the meeting agenda or currently pending before the water board. Comments regarding matters that are under development for future meetings or not within the water board's regulatory authority will be restricted. Comments regarding pending or impending adjudicatory matters will not be allowed. Do we have any speaker cards for this forum, Katrina? Ariel?
No.
Thank you. Hearing none, we'll now move to item two, board meeting minutes. Before the Water Board will consider adopting the minutes of the regular meeting on January 30th, 2025, AEO Ben Letton has a statement.
Thank you, Board Chair. There's a correction for the minutes that brought to my attention. It is on bait stamp. Excuse me. Let me pull it up. Bait stamp 2-7. In 2-7, there's a motion made by Dr. Cox, moved to nominate Esther Mustafavi as chair for 2025. Was seconded by Board Member Pierce. Chair Horn called for a roll call vote and motion carried for the following votes. There's an error. Member Deaver voted nay and Member Lux voted aye.
Is there a motion to approve the board minutes with the aforementioned correction?
Move approval of the minutes with the correction.
We'll now take a vote. Board Member Deaver.
Excuse me, Chair. Don't we need a second?
I'll second.
That's it. When there's a board vote, a second motion is just a customary practice, but it's not necessary to have a vote. Sorry, Board Member Deaver.
Aye.
Board Member Lux.
Aye.
Board Member Cox.
Aye.
Board Member Pierce.
Aye.
Board Member Horn.
Aye.
And I vote aye as well. Next, we move to item three, reports by the Water Board. The Water Board members will provide updates to the Water Board and the public on events and activities of interest. First, I wanted to take a moment to remember our late Executive Officer, Mike Flasiak. Mike came on as EO at a point when the region needed insightful vision and direction. He possessed a rare ability to translate those visions into tangible action, driving progress with a resolute spirit. His legacy of proactive engagement and thoughtful leadership will undoubtedly continue to inspire our work, and he leaves big shoes to fill in our search for a new executive officer. Next, I'd like to speak about the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting, or WQCC, held in Sacramento earlier this month. In addition to hearing regional issues, there was significant time dedicated to the expectations for appointed regional water quality control board members. This memo was circulated amongst the board for comment. To offer a brief synopsis, there was emphasis on how appointed members of California's regional water quality control boards play a crucial role in safeguarding the state's water resources by implementing federal and state water quality laws. These semi-autonomous boards, composed of volunteers appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, function as part administrator, planner, and adjudicator, addressing critical issues that impact the health and sustainability of California's environment and people. As members, we're expected to uphold professionalism, integrity, and dedication to public service. And again, if you haven't already done so, I encourage the board to reach out to Michael Law for if you have any particular insights regarding the memo. Next, we'll hear from Board Member Deaver. Do you have anything to report?
Yeah, I was struck. It was a good 2 days webinar. Struck by the member from Region 9 reporting on the Tijuana River. You could hear the stress in her voice. You know, I've been to Imperial Beach a lot. I've been down to Coronado. I didn't realize how bad it smelled. She brought that up. So really interesting, and I hope they can square that away in the future. That's it.
Thank you. Board Member Lux.
Yeah, just two quick ones. I was able to attend the second day of the WQCC and really enjoyed the presentations, mostly just listened in. And I was just very pleased with our interim executive director, Ben Letton's summary. He did a great job of talking about our region. And thanks, Ben, for doing that. Second thing, I talk a tiny bit about a thing going on the Truckee River. I seem to always do that, but I like the Truckee River. So. There's a really interesting project that the town of Truckee is the lead on, but all the agencies and all the organizations around the river are involved, called the River Revitalization Steering Committee, or lovingly R2SC. And it's kind of a land use project, and I won't go into the details of it. It's updating a kind of a river strategy that was done over a decade ago. And there's a lot of fairly typical things in there about river health and access and environmental policy and good things of that sort and setbacks. There's one component that I think is really interesting that you don't see often, and I hope it bears fruit, which is this economic vitality aspect of it. And the idea is to move a bunch of old industrial uses, most of which are vacant and causing water quality problems, provide incentives to move those out in favor of modernized land uses, whatever that might be, and improve stormwater practices and restoration of the river edges. So even though it's a land use project, it's going to have water quality implications. Anyway, it's something to follow. It's called the River Revitalization Steering Committee, and I keep up on it through an organization that I belong to up there. Thanks.
Thank you. Board Member Cox?
No report. Thank you.
Board Member Pierce?
No report. Thank you.
Board Member Horn?
Thank you. Yes, I was able to attend remotely both days of WQCC, and I thought it was one of the best WQCCs ever. I was particularly interested in the wastewater needs assessment work, including the concept of the human right to sanitation, and all the different agencies that are involved in and pieces of legislation that are interconnected in trying to implement that concept. The second thing I wanted to mention is that this August, as there has been every August since 1997, there will be a Tahoe Summit. And any board member who is able to attend this one-day event, I encourage you to attend. This was begun back in, as I said, 1997 by President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore, and it launched the Environmental Improvement Project, which has poured millions of dollars into improving the environment within the Lake Tahoe Basin, including the water quality in the lake. And what happens is there's speechifying by elected officials from California, Nevada. Every year, a senator, they alternate between Nevada and California senators organizing the event. This year, the organizer will be Senator Adam Schiff. And I hear that he's on top of it and making good progress planning the summit. There's usually an announcement of a check of money coming from Washington to support the Environmental Improvement Program. Sometimes agency officials like Secretary of the Department of Interior or someone comes. But for me, the best part is the interacting that happens before the summit. A lot of agencies and organizations, nonprofits, booths and have information available. You can talk to people, get to know them, ask questions. I learn a lot every year at the Tahoe Summit. And so keep your eyes out for the announcement of that. It's a great, very uplifting day, and it's a lot of fun.
If you could share the dates with the board, that would be great.
Well, that's up to the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, not me.
So. Okay, great. Next is item 4, Executive Officer's Report.
Good morning, Board Chair, Mr. Favi, and members of the board. My name is Ben Letton. I'm the Assistant Executive Officer and Acting Executive Officer. I'll be providing you item 4 in your board packet, starting on page stamp 4-1. This report's going to be a little bit on the longer side, just because there's a lot to update you since our last board meeting in January. So if it's okay with the board chair, I'd like to take questions and comments as we go, just so you know.
That works.
All right. Okay, before I get started on the meat of the report, I would like to take a few minutes to acknowledge our late executive officer, Mike Plaziak. Mike, as you know, passed away, or many of you know, on April 10th, 2025, after a long battle with lymphoma. He was a beloved husband, brother, son, father, friend, and he was our executive officer from the end of 2020 until the his retirement, which occurred actually in late March of 2025, a few days before he passed. His role here at Lahan was as an exceptional leader. I showed this slide at Water Quality Coordinating Committee on May 1st, and it is certainly worth sharing again with you and the public today. In creating this slide, I combined our regional values that we developed with staff, and Mike was really instrumental in leading that activity. And it also integrates a lot of Mike's personal leadership qualities. Mike led with integrity and emotional intelligence. He was always grounded in strong morale and ethical values. He created a safe and inclusive space where every voice was valued and respected. Mike was extremely humble, yet he was decisive, a leader who listened with vulnerability and openness, yet never hesitated to take time to make strategic decisions that moved us forward. He was also a true team builder. He united people through respect and transparency, skillfully managing conflict and encouraging collaboration rooted in trust and accountability. He was also a visionary with a human touch. He balanced bold strategic thinking with compassion, empathy, and a deep understanding of the human experience. And he walked the talk. He modeled the behavior he expected from others, always approachable, holding themselves to the highest standard, or himself to the highest standard of honesty, balance, and fairness. Mike embodied all of these things. I had a chance over the past few weeks to host several all-staff meetings where staff were able to pay tribute to Mike. My wife Maria also invited us to a mass that was held at the St. Teresa Catholic Church recently. And there's a funeral service in Miramar and San Diego, all of which were well attended by friends, family, and our water board staff. So I want to thank Maria for including this. And when I close here, I just wanted to close by sharing some funny sayings that Mike had, Mike-isms we call them, because I think they were important at a time when we were trying to really institute a lot of cultural change. And his phrases really also connected with a lot of the values that we have into the organization and a lot of the improvements that we were trying to make. So one of those was, it doesn't have to be perfect, it just has to be good. So Mike was a perfectionist and he understood this. And I think it was one of the areas that he was always trying to improve on himself. But I think he helped us get away from, you know, having to make something absolutely perfect and all the time and resources that requires. I mean, of course, there's some things you have to get perfect, but there's a lot of things, you know, that we do where it just has to be good. And that's really helped us in terms of our work with workload and our pace of work. He also talked about getting the right people on the bus. So that was Mike's way of talking about recruitment and talent recruitment and retaining people that we recruit, you know, creating a high level of staff morale, making Lahontan a place that is inviting for people to work at and a great culture. He also said, be well and be safe. That's the way he ended a lot of meetings. And he was big on safety. You know, he was in the military, also worked in the wind industry. So he was always extremely concerned and attentive to staff need and staff safety. He also had one, let's not change happy to glad. That was also one related to, it doesn't have to be perfect, it has to be good. He helped us focus on the content of a lot of our documents and messages and you know, let's not get too caught up in semantics that don't really change the meaning. So that was another big one he emphasized. He probably, his most famous quote was the bluff, which was bottom line up front. That's a military term, and it's used for really concise, short briefings in the military, and that's the way he wanted to be briefed himself. He wanted to convey information. So in other words, just tell me what we're here for in this meeting or this brief. I'll then ask questions and work backwards in terms of getting more background information and content if needed. And that really helps streamline a lot of our communications. He also said, had a phrase about removing rocks from our pack. That was offloading unnecessary work that was slowing us down. You know, let's lighten our load in terms of our work efficiency. And so that was another one that Mike said a lot. He also referred to sausage making, which I think is just part of the bureaucratic process. And he always acknowledged it, like, don't worry, this is just the sausage making phase right now. We'll get through it. And finally, he said a lot, living the dream. And he was just very grateful for his opportunities. And he said it even, you know, in the last few months of his life, even when I saw him last at the hospital, living the dream. So thank you, Mike. We'll miss you. And he's a great leader. It'll be tough to fill those shoes. I think we're well positioned to do so and carry on his legacy. Okay, so a lot's happened in terms of personnel since the last board meeting. So this personnel report covers February 2025 through April of 2025. I want to thank Sandra Lopez for helping me out with this slide. A lot of movement, tough to keep track of. Thank you, Sandra. So the promotion, Lori Scrieb promoted to Senior Environmental Scientist Supervisor for the non-point source unit. Congratulations, Lori. We also have Jacqueline Royer, an environmental scientist in the Planning and Assessment Unit, a new hire, as well as Abby Kezier. She's the Senior Water Resource Control Engineer Specialist of the Leviathan Mine Unit now. In terms of separations and retirements, Mike's retirement in late March, Chris Stetler also has retired, and Tiffany Bierlich, Water Resource Control Engineer in the Regulatory Enforcement Unit under Trevor Miller also left us. In terms of upcoming retirements, Eric Shea, our administrative officer, is going to be retiring in, I think, October. Lisa Scorale, I understand, will be retiring sometime in the summer. I don't recall the exact month. Katrina Fleshman, the end of July of this year, and Cynthia White, our staff service analyst. So vacancies include executive officer, water resource control engineer supervisor now in the Leviathan Mine Unit. That was Abby's former position that's now vacant. Water resource control engineer regulatory enforcement, that's Tiffany Bierlich position. And then we have two scientific aid positions open, one in the non-point source unit and the other in regulatory enforcement. Remember, questions as we go or comments if you have any. So I'd like to profile a number of articles from the January EO report, starting on stamp 4-5 of your board packet. I don't have time to summarize all the great articles in the EO packet, but I picked out a few that I thought would be the most interest to the board and perhaps where the board had particular comments and questions. So the first one I want to highlight is a summary of a public outreach meeting. Present the 2024 timber waiver. This was written by Jeremy Feinberg, I believe is in attendance this morning. So in January, staff conducted a public outreach meeting. The purpose was to educate the public and regulated community to learn more about the new requirements of the timber waiver. Staff remained committed to conducting future outreach meetings to educate public and the regulated community about the timber waiver. And also is intent on gathering information to help develop future waste discharge requirements. And this was a commitment that we made to the board last fall when you adopted the timber waiver, was to make sure we did a number of outreach events. The second article is the 2026 Integrated Report released by the State Water Board. This is by Danny McClure. Essentially, the State Water Board released the draft 2026 integrated report for a 45-day public comment period in January. The Clean Water Act requires that the states report on the quality of their service waters every 2 years. So in meeting this requirement, California developed a list of service waters now meeting the standard and overall assessment of the waters of the state. The Planning and Assessment Unit, led by Dan Sussman, is the team responsible for assessing service water data for over 3,000 pollutant water body combinations. In the 2026 integrated report would add 151 new water body pollutant listings in the Lahontan region, and would remove 35 from the 303D list. Coincident with public comment in January, Lahontan staff contacted key stakeholders who have previously participated in integrated report development to discuss specific listings and delisting decisions. State Water Board consideration of the 2026 integrated report is scheduled for the winter of 25-26. And then the last article in January that I want to profile was a standing item related to grazing. This is by Mo Loden. The update covers the period from February 2024 through January of 2025. It also summarizes efforts that the Water Board staff have been working on in the Bridgeport Valley, Eagle Lake, Bishop Creek, and the West Fork Carson River. So in each of those areas, we take a slightly different regulatory approach. And there's a really nice table in there, table 6.1 on Bates Stamp 4-12, that summarizes the different regulatory approach we take for each of those areas. The report also talks about at a state level, Water Board has been working over the past several years to update the 1995 California Rangeland Water Quality Management Plan. Staff have been participating in that process. It also speaks to some new legislation that the governor signed into law in September 24. It's a SB 675, a bill that promotes prescribed grazing, vegetation management, especially for fire prevention and other environmental considerations. And finally, I'd like to mention that our staff regularly attend the Rangeland Management Advisory Committee, or RMAC, the subcommittee of the Board of Forestry that meets regularly, once every 2 months, I understand. Staff often provide feedback to RMAC for documents they produce. Examples include prescribed herbivory for vegetation management projects and also the state lands grazing guidebook.
If I have a question, do I ask it, or what? What's the procedure for asking a question? Thank you. So in that write-up on grazing, there was a I had heard before a designated vegetative buffer. Two questions about that. What is it? And secondly, how does that compare in cost to fencing along streams? On a tour of Centennial Ranch a few years ago, I was flabbergasted at the cost of fencing that Centennial Ranch has been. And I'm wondering if the vegetative strip might be a more cost effective way to achieve that goal.
Well, I'll take a swing at that first, since I do have some work I did a long time ago related to grazing. I think a designated vegetative buffer strip is a strip of vegetation that's left, you know, adjacent to a water body or an area where pollutants could be conveyed into a surface water. Perhaps there's some exclusion fencing or some ever barrier to keep animals from grazing on that vegetative strip, but I would, Mary concurs with my explanation. So I think in essence, that's what it is. Actually, Rob Pierce might be able to expand on that, since he's a kind of an expert of his own.
I agree with that. You know, NRCS actually has a practice, they call it riparian buffer strip. Is that the same concept? But oftentimes that does include. It's pretty hard to have a vegetative buffer strip along a stream or creek and have cattle in there that are not. I mean, it's more about the purpose of the vegetation of the buffer strip.
As opposed to keeping the cows out of the stream?
No, I mean, it's just a process, the vegetation buffer strip. It's a process. In my mind, it's not going to do bacteria and all that stuff. Those vegetative buffers don't know if you agree with that or not, Mary.
I think she does.
Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of cost effectiveness, I don't really know the response to that. I mean, drift fencing, which is temporary, can be effective in terms of setting up the initial exclusion area for a designated buffer strip. That's probably more cost effective than permanent fencing, but it's not as flexible. Or, you know, drift fencing can be more flexible than permanent fencing in terms of where you place it strategically.
But it's not addressing the issue of E. coli. What I'm hearing Dr. Pierce say.
Mary has something to say now.
Good morning, board chair, members of the board. Mary Fiore, environmental program manager with the compliance and planning division. I would just add, because Amy, I see that where that is mentioned in the report, it does mention cow pad. And the vegetative buffer strip was absent along with fencing. They do kind of work together. I would add, you may have some advantage for E. coli reduction if that vegetative buffer strip allowed some spreading and time for the contaminated water to be exposed to sunlight and break down. There is that possibility if it was in place. But I agree with Rob that they kind of go hand in hand because you won't have the vegetative buffer without the fence because the cows are going to eat grass.
And we're going to have a field tour in July as part of the July board meeting. We're going to go out and look at some ranches in the Bishop area. They're participating in the Bishop Creek Vision Plan. So these are excellent things to bring up during that field tour. Okay, let's talk about the February portion of the EO report. It starts on BASAM 4-23 in your board packet. There are a lot of great articles here too. So the first one I'd like to highlight is a article by Alonzo Poach and Lorian Sanders, Air Force presentation to Mojave Water Agency Technical Advisory Committee, impacts of Adelanto publicly owned treatment works discharge on former George Air Force Base, a mouthful. In essence here, the staff attended a presentation that was put on by former George Air Force Base to the Technical Advisory Committee. A little background on that. You know, the Air Force has raised concerns that discharge from the city of Adelanto wastewater treatment plant infiltration pond is causing groundwater levels to rise. And this rise in groundwater is believed to be affecting the remediation and cleanup efforts at the southern portion of former George Air Force Base by pushing contamination plumes into the previously uncontaminated areas and impacting the effectiveness of existing remedies. In response to these concerns, staff have been actively involved in evaluating the Air Force's claims and working collaboratively with the Air Force and the US EPA and surrounding communities to make progress in cleanup efforts at former George. The Water Board staff have also been instrumental in facilitating discussions and meetings, such as with the Mojave Water Agency Technical Advisory Committee, to ensure that all stakeholders are informed and involved in the decision-making process. Water Board staff have also been advocating for reestablishing regular public meetings, such as the Restoration Advisory Board or the RAB, to engage the community and provide updates to the cleanup progress. Through these efforts, the Lahontan Water Board staff are playing a crucial role in protecting water quality and supporting the remediation efforts. The next article is about the budget reduction impacts to the Regional Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program by Lori Scribe. Essentially, the State Water Resource Control Board has implemented an approximately 8% reduction in operating budgets as required by budget letter 2424. And this resulted in permanent cuts of all operating or operational funding to the 9 regional water quality boards, the surface water ambient monitoring programs. So there's a partial cut for fiscal year 2425 and then permanent cuts start in fiscal year 25-26. We did some shifting of resources around, particularly augmenting that budget with our discretionary contract funds. And we will be able to maintain for now water quality monitoring at long-term trend sites, harmful algal bloom program, laboratory analysis, fish tissue bioaccumulation monitoring, and the development of probabilistic phase survey design for long-term regional monitoring. Water Board staff are striving to continue, again, all these regional monitoring activities. However, the future of the program is uncertain unless State Water Board can replace the original swamp funds, as existing funds will expire in June of 2027.
I have some question about that comment. So how will these cuts in the swamp program, particularly if they continue beyond this year, affect future versions of our integrated report?
I'm going to defer to either Dan or Lori if they're in the room.
Dan Sussman, supervisor of the Planning and Assessment Unit. I also going to say that Lori Strieb is here, and Dan Clark is our program manager for the integrated report. If you have more questions on that. So we get a lot of our data, you were right, for our integrated report assessments from our swamp work. In cycles past, it was up to 90-95%. More recently, the integrated report been incorporating federal databases as well, the USGS database, tribal data as well that pulls in some of the tribal reservation and rancheria land and the like. So it would impact us for sure if we were unable to go out and collect the data ourselves. It wouldn't be the end of it. There is other data that we assess. One of the other things that's in that EO report I believe is speaking to is we're also sort of strategizing how to move forward with the program. Right now we are using existing funds that we're already in contract to take us for a couple more seasons. And then beyond that, there's a couple different options for with one of them is to and none of these have fully been decided, but one of them would be to have a reliable portion of our region-wide laboratory funds go towards helping with the swamp analysis. Another one is to perhaps give part of our annual discretionary contract fund towards that program, and then of course as you might be familiar, whenever there is a need, the state can put together a budget change proposal and seek to reestablish that funding for. So things are not all pretty and roses and everything, but we're trying to stay away from our doomsday scenarios as well.
I mean, thank you for that. I mean, this is really important because this is determining, the list of surface waters that we're looking for, maybe doing a TMDL or some alternative regulatory approach, or delisting, keeping the current understanding of the water surface water quality in our region is pretty important. So, but I just want to say that the four bullet points that were listed in the article as being the priority for the next year make a lot of sense to me. It looks like you used the line of sight to determine those bullet points, which someone may want to explain to the new board members if they don't know what it is. And I love the probabilistic based survey design, having studied designing surveys for forested ecosystems. I know how difficult that is, and it was bad enough for forested ecosystems. For the entire Manhattan region, but this will make the whole sampling system much more efficient and effective. So kudos on that. That's really important. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Dan. The next article is the Truckee River Watershed Enforcement Strategy. Team Work Diligently to Address Water Quality Concerns in the Area by Shelby Barker. So essentially, we had a history over the past several years of non-compliance concerns and complaints about alleged impacts to water quality in the Truckee River Watershed Area. That included observed violations, including violations of our floodplain prohibitions, non-compliance with permits, and failure to obtain permits. These permits include stormwater permits, industrial water sites, construction sites, and municipal entities, along with permits for soil disturbance within waterways. So we put together a team, a multidisciplinary team from a lot of different programs that issue those types of permits. Steps taken so far is that we've increased the number of inspections and issuance of many informal enforcement notices. We've also pursued cleanup and abatement orders, 13267 orders, and administrative civil liabilities where appropriate. Staff have cataloged and recorded a lot of industrial and construction stormwater violations. In some cases, those violations have escalated to formal enforcement. We're following up on several complaints regarding municipal stormwater problems, and we're also pursuing complaints about disturbances within the 100-year floodplain. And we have been communicating and collaborating a lot more closely with local agencies to improve communication, regular meetings with Placer County, Nevada County, and the town of Truckee. And then just real quick on the last two bullets there, on bait stamp 4-36, I included a lengthy list of high profile or high priority pieces of legislation that the water boards are tracking. They're really focused in groundwater quality and forestry and wildfire. I plan on continuing those types of legislative updates moving forward, and we'll provide an update to that list of priority bills at our July board meeting. And then there's a new section on bait stamp 4-40, which is a list of items on upcoming board meetings for May and July. I think we'll probably make that a separate enclosure rather than a new article moving forward. It'll be similar to your list of standing board items that's on bait stamp 4-81. Moving forward, we'll just have that as an enclosure.
And I believe board member Lowe had a question.
Oh, yeah.
And not a question, just a very quick kudo back to the Truckee River. You mentioned it, the coordination with town, the two counties, and also Caltrans. And that sounds so mundane and obvious, and it isn't either, those of us who worked in that world. So really important, because that's where the sediment hits the road, so to speak, and appreciate the extra effort.
Yeah, I mean, one little thing related to that is that, you know, the city and the county, they have their own ordinances and permitting as well. And so making sure there's alignment in permitting requirements, or at least they're aware of ours and we're aware of theirs when people come to, you know, pull like building permits, for example, with the city. That's been a big part of it, is just educating our staff and their staff that we know, you know, what each of us are trying to do has been a big part of that.
So I want to echo everything Jeff said about the Truckee River Enforcement Program. Just in case those of you may be skeptical about whether separation of functions works, the first I heard of this was when Ben talked about it at WQCC. So pleasantly surprised and really pleased at the coordinated approach that you guys have taken in the Truckee River Watershed Council. Phrase that's sort of interrupted to my brain. At the Truckee River Watershed, with all the partners. You know, I mean, with all of the work that's been done in the Tahoe Basin, a lot of activity has shifted to the Truckee River Watershed. And We've been so, Lawton has been so focused on the Tahoe Basin that kind of took our eye off the ball in the past year, what was happening in the Truckee River. So I'm thrilled that you're now really focusing on the Truckee River. Keep up the good work.
Indeed. Thank you. All right, let's go to March 2025. A few articles I'd like to touch on here.
Before you leave this section, back to the airport item on 4:30, which is an opportunity to jump in. But let us never forget that the Air Force and their team method of remediation in that area is natural attenuation. So we cannot forget that. I have heard the assertions made. I'm not sure that the science backs up the assertion that the military cleanup team is making. So I just caution our staff to be watchful of that and use sound science as they participate in these conversations. But natural attenuation is their method of cleanup. Thank you.
Thank you, Kimberly. Okay, safe to go on to March. So this starts on stamp 4-55 in your board packet. First article is titled Department of Defense Program Overview and Funding Challenges by Alonzo Poach. Just a little background, the Department of Defense Cleanup Program is a cost recovery initiative managed by the State Water Resources Control Board. And the 9 regional boards that oversees cleanup activities, current and former military facilities through the state, funded through the Defense Environmental Restoration Program. DERP is funded by Congress every 2 years through the National Defense Authorization Act. The fund is managed by the Department of Toxic Substance Control and accessed by the Water Board through an interagency agreement, typically. Funding allocations are approximately $8.5 million per year, and we have 6.6 staff or PYs for that program. So I think this is an example of some of the federal cuts that are occurring and how it's impacting some of our programs and staff. Due to the budget cuts from the Navy, Defense Logistics Agency, and Air Force, the funding for the fiscal year 24-26 cycle will only be awarded about 82% of the requested amount. This leads to a more proactive approach to tracking program expenditures and the development of new tools by the Water Board to monitor spending through the year. We have 8 active military facilities in Region 6, and 1 facility is a closed installation, former George Air Force Base. So in March of 2025, there's a stop work order issued by the State Board. This didn't affect Region 6 too much because we only oversee active Navy installations.
Sorry, I wanted to jump back to one in the prior EO report, which is the fourth quarter violations and discharge report, unauthorized discharge report. Just a comment, which I think I'm seeing the benefits of the increased field presence. That there's been an emphasis on for the staff work over the last year and in the enforcement and compliance. So I just wanted to compliment you on that and wanted to know if that emphasis is going to continue in the future.
In a couple slides, I have dedicated one slide for Shelby to talk about the quarterly evaluation and discharge report. Can we wait for her to come
yes,
up to?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Yes.
The next article for March was streamlined permitting with Region 6. First general 401 water quality certification. This is by Megan Walsh and Liz Van Diepen. So the region's, again, first general 401 water quality cert streamlines the permitting process for minimal impacts in Lake Tahoe by granting a blanket exemption to the basin plan prohibitions and setting clear expectations for contractors and consultants. The order categorizes activities into non-notifying and notifying categories. Non-notifying categories which require no application include mooring buoys, fish habitat mitigation, and scientific devices. Notifying activities which require an application include building new piers, bulkheads, and benthic barriers. Lead staff conducted outreach efforts with stakeholders and partner agencies to ensure the order's effectiveness. The order has been well received since its adoption in March 7th, with several applicants already enrolled and positive feedback received from all.
I have a question about that one.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you could be more specific about how enforcement authority is maintained without requiring notice or an application.
Does staff want to try that one, Liz?
For the non-notifying categories, we, I guess, would mostly be relying on complaints and notifications from other agencies if issues do come up. Those non-notifying activities were really thought about carefully, and those are currently what we feel are the most minimal type of activities. You know, buoy block installations is very minimal, and so are the other notifying activities we covered there.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. The next article is emergence of land applications in rural areas in Region 6 by Tiara Cruces, Bait Stamp 4-59. So over the past year, we've had a lot of complaints about land application of potentially contaminated mulch, compost, and sludge in rural areas in Los Angeles and Kern counties. These complaints highlight issues such as improper handling, environmental impacts, and the presence of contaminants like plastic and construction debris. Land application activities typically require permits from the local enforcement agency or the LEA and Cal Recycle. However, many activities are being conducted without the necessary permits, leading to concerns about illegal dumping. The Water Board has been involved in inspections and regulatory oversight to address the issue. In response to a rise in the land application and number of complaints, Cal Recycle has proposed and adopted emergency regulations to define and regulate land application activities. These regulations aim to protect public health and the environment by establishing operator filing requirements, state minimum standards, and record keeping for solid waste facilities. You know, our goal really in this issue is to strengthen partnerships with agencies like Cal Recycle and county authorities to streamline communication, regulation, jurisdictional responsibilities, and enforcement efforts to triage cases that warrant further follow-up. Staff are currently actively working on developing a formalized process for emerging concerns of land applications within the region. And finally, a standing item, vision plan implementation for both the Bishop and West Fort Carson. This is by Mo Loden and Danny McClure. So under the Clean Water Act, the states are required to develop TMDLs or other regulatory actions to address water quality impairments. US EPA has encouraged a variety of approaches, including advanced restoration plans. And if these plans are successful over a 10-year period, then a TMDL may not be necessary. So a vision plan is one of those advanced restoration plans. So with respect to the Bishop Creek vision plan, this plan aims to reduce bacteria inputs from controllable sources such as commercial cattle operations, transient dispersed camping, small-scale hobby ranching, and pet waste. Currently, data indicates that ruminants are the primary source of bacteria at Bishop Creek. The plan emphasized collaboration with local stakeholders, including the Bishop Paiute Tribe, NRCS, UC Cooperative Extension, to develop outreach and implementation strategies for reducing bacteria contamination from residential backyards. Implementation efforts began in 2024 with a variety of various local agencies involved. We've been meeting with the City of Bishop and other stakeholders who have been held to discuss these watershed health issues. With respect to the West Fort Carson Vision Plan, the plan targets multiple pollutant sources, including suspended solids, salts, and nutrients. It involves tracking project implementation and monitoring water quality to assess progress. Several restoration projects, such as the Faith Valley Meadow Restoration and the West Carson River Habitat Improvement Project, have been completed. These projects aim to reduce erosion and improve watershed function. The plan requires engagement with several water board programs and includes commitments to report annually to the board on progress. It also involves coordination with various agencies and stakeholders to implement across identified in the plan. And I just want to draw your attention to the West Fort Carson Vision Plan Implementation Summary Table on Bait Stamp 4-67. It's really thorough. And I love the way that Danny, I don't know if it was Danny and Mo or just Dan here both, but the way they put that table together, it's pretty slick.
And Board Member Lux had a question.
Yeah, just a question. And if it's a lengthy answer, I can take it offline, so I don't need to take a lot of time with it. But really intrigued by these vision plans. They're very, well, they're great. Who initiates one and how does that happen? In other words, do they just sort of pop up out of thin air, or how does a vision plan go from an idea to then happen?
Yeah, well, I know the vision plans have to have the same 9 elements of a TMDL, but it's more in a voluntary or informal sort of regulatory setting. But I'd like to defer to Danny or Mo, if they're in the audience, to give them a chance.
And my main question is sort of kind of how they happen. You know, can we just?
Yeah. Or Dan Sussman.
How do you get one going?
Good morning, Dan Sussman, supervisor of the Planning and Assessment Unit, which includes the TMDL program. So the USEPA has a vision for addressing 3D waters that they put out and regularly update every 5 years or every 10 years. And so in these were in the last vision period, which ended in 2023, I want to say, they brought this idea of being able to address waters that are impaired waters through, they wanted to add some more flexibility to the program. I think it grew out of a little bit of the fact that outside of California, a lot of the TMDL requirements don't actually have an implementation plan. And so you have the option to just create paper and not put it into practice. But what we really want and what we seek here in California and have sought here in California is to have those result in water quality improvements. And so it put forth sort of this vision of being able to kick the can down the road in terms of needing a TMDL if there are other ways to address water quality impairments that might in situations that might lend themselves to more collaborative approaches and the like. And so one of the ways that we do this is to do what we've been calling our vision plans. That parlance isn't broad and wide outside of Lahontan. It's, you know, because a vision, something to meet the EPA vision, could be just a traditional TMDL as well. And so, gosh, what is it, 2025, probably 7 years ago or so, we were asked to commit to which water bodies do you want to work on to address under the EPA vision. And we chose Bishop Creek and the West Fort Carson River. And the reason why we did so is because there were already some identified stakeholders and that there were some the types of pollution and the types of in the landscape and folks to work with, it seemed to be that would it'd be a good fit. And so we decided to initiate these plans as non-regulatory based plans with the goal of coming up with some approach with partnerships that, you know, there might be regulatory elements, but the plan itself did not add anything new to that. So long as there are willing parties to that are willing to engage with us and work forward with it. It was a worthwhile approach. And so right now we're in the midst of implementing that. We'll see how it goes. We have these annual reports that come to you, and then 5 years down the line, so another 4 years or so, we'll take a look back at these annual reports and give sort of a bigger update, a recommendation like, yeah, let's keep going on course, or if there are some changes to be made. And then, of course, in 10 years, that will also be the case. Our goal is to have water quality improved by then, which would obviate the need for developing a TMDL. So it's a short answer after that real long answer is we look at the water body, we look at the impairment, we look at the landscape and the folks in it and say, hey, is this a good fit? And if it is, great, we'll go forward and do something that's not a TMDL in hopes of getting water quality without that. And if it's not, we might just jump straight into a TMDL.
Well, you've answered the question I was going to ask, which so I will follow up with the comment I was going to make anyway, which is, this seems to me the future direction for the water board, wherever it might fit these criteria that you've outlined, because instead of regulating discharger by discharger, pollutant by, I mean, this really jumped out at me going through Danny's wonderful table. Really cool. It really helped me understand what was going on there. Because instead of pollutant by pollutant, discharger by discharger, it's looking at the watershed as a whole and, you know, addressing the most effective, highest priority items collaboratively through partnerships. Seems to me a much more efficient way to go towards improving water quality. You have buy-in from the stakeholders. I realize that's important, but I think it's a very exciting tool, and I hope that we see more of it in the future where it's applicable.
Yeah, thank you. It isn't always easier or less work.
I'm sure.
but it is, you know, a good tool.
And while I have the microphone, I just want to take this opportunity to compliment everyone, the team, on the high quality of the EO reports written up for this board packet. I was blown away. In fact, those are the very words I texted Ben after I read these EO reports. So I really appreciate the time that you put into writing these things. The quality of these EO reports is really reflected in the effort you put in. So thank you for that.
I just have one question. I think it was in the report, but I can't remember. On the Bishop Vision Creek, how many of the producers that are directly related to the Bishop Creek have actually got a plan in place?
I think in the report, I was reading it, it's most actually out right now. It is said about half of them had a ranch quality management plan. I talked to her. We were in the office past 5 last night. I actually didn't arrive until then because it's a work day at home for me. And I was talking to her about, are you going to be there tomorrow? And she's actually in Bishop right now. And so she is, I think, planning on, tying. She has a couple meetings and she's going to, I think one of them was adding one more to the completion.
Yeah, my understanding, she was also meeting with the Bishop Creek Water Association, which is all the residential areas that impact that area.
That's right.
Thanks.
Okay, any more questions on January, February, or March articles? Okay, thanks. I'd like to turn it over to...
I believe Board Member Cox had something to say.
Well, I just wanted to comment. I love these EO reports. It just gives us such an exposure to all the different things that are going on by the Water Board staff, and I really, really appreciate that. So thank you.
Yeah, it was. I want to compliment staff too for their contributions. You know, we asked for some changes in the structure and the content of the EO report, and they came through in a major way. So. All right, I'd like to hand this over to Shelby Barker for an update on the unauthorized discharge and quarterly violations report that starts on 8 stamp 4-43 in your board packet.
Good morning, Chair Mustafavi and fellow board members. My name is Shelby Barker, and I'm the Senior Engineering Geologist Specialist in the Regulatory and Cleanup Division and the Enforcement Coordinator for the region. I'm speaking about the fourth quarter violations and unauthorized discharge report and other enforcement actions that began. The report starts on bait stamp 4-43. The article associated begins on bait stamp 4-41 of your board packet. In total, there were 45 violations documented during fourth quarter. Of those 45, 8 were unauthorized discharges, and cleanup activities were completed for all 8 of those. Only 1 of those 8 had reached surface waters. That incident occurred in Alpine County, where a pilot had parked their privately owned helicopter on the embankment of the East Fork Carson River. The helicopter slid down the embankment and into the river. No release had occurred other than a helicopter in the water, and the helicopter was removed. We had coordinated with other agencies as well. More information about that incident is provided in the January EO report, the article entitled Spill Response East Fork Carson River Helicopter Incident, which begins on bait stamp 4-7. There were also a couple enforcement items that occurred during fourth quarter. As you guys are aware, during the board November board meeting in Bishop, the regional board had considered a revised proposed ACL, or administrative civil liability, for David Park and Park Livestock Company, and the board had imposed a civil liability of $20,000 for violations of the California Water Code and Federal Clean Water Act regarding sediment discharge to the West Walker River. And also, there was a proposed amended cleanup and abatement order, or CAO, for Janesville Payless gas station that was posted for public comments. The proposed amended CAO names Linda Hardy, Jody Elena, Ramesh Taran, and Rajinder Singh as dischargers, and orders cleanup of discharges of petroleum products for the gas station. Comments were due December 9th. And no comments were received. One of the biggest things I wanted to highlight for this report, violations report, is in the past it was violations report. It is now the violations and unauthorized discharges report. In the past, we had presented unauthorized discharge reports on a monthly basis, and a violations report on a quarterly basis. This really resulted in a disjointed presentation of information to the board. Some unauthorized discharges were duplicated in the violations report at regulated facilities. And it really just made this separation of things that are should be really be presented together. So moving forward, we're proposing having the quarterly violations and unauthorized discharges report combined, where all the information is succinct and provided as one item. And then to address Dr. Horn's question, if I understood it correctly, about whether we have seen increased compliance with our efforts with the increased field presence. And the short answer is yes. So one of our enforcement goals throughout the region has been to increase field presence to encourage compliance with existing permits, as well as to better assist dischargers to identify the violations early on and to be able to correct them and return to compliance as soon as possible with minimal informal enforcement, such as verbal enforcement when we're out doing the field inspections, staff enforcement letters, which includes email communication, and following up with notices of violation. I'd like to note that during fourth quarter, there has been, I'm not going to say minimal, but reduced field presence. Given that most of our active sites that are in the northern portion of our region have been winterized. So moving forward, now that spring's here, we should be seeing more of the increased compliance and any violations being corrected rapidly with our field presence and our staff going out to see these sites. I hope that answered the question. I hope I understood it correctly. And that's pretty much it for me. If anybody had any questions regarding the violations report and unauthorized discharges.
I don't see any hands raised here in the room. So thank you, Shelby. Mm-hmm. And I just want to note that this was one of the regional priorities that I emphasized at WQCC was our enforcement program. And a lot of the credit goes to Shelby as our enforcement coordinator for really revitalizing our enforcement work, including great ideas like combining reports. So there you go. Okay, I mentioned this earlier. This was an article I slipped into the EO report, which is essentially gives you a preview of what's coming up. You know what's hopefully on the agenda for today, so I'll just go over the list here for July. Multiple facilities rescission order, annual enforcement update, accomplishments and priorities, triennial review, Department of Defense program overview, and Bishop Creek vision project update and field tour. So I'm going to include these as an enclosure, this list rather than an article moving forward. I mentioned that previously, so hopefully you found it useful. And then finally, just wanted to go over the items for the coming month of April, which will be on-site septic systems and salt and nutrient management plans. And that concludes my EO report. Thank you for allowing me to, you know, have an expanded EO report. It was a number of months to go over. There's a lot to talk about, and I really appreciate the comments and questions and the dialogue that just occurred here with the board. It's helpful for us. Good input and feedback. And I'll take any last minute questions or comments. Okay, thank you.
It's now 10:12. We will take a 10-minute recess and resume at 10:22. Next is item 5, Desert Oasis Dairy Revision. The Water Board will hold a public hearing to receive public comments and to consider adopting revised waste discharge requirements for the Desert Oasis Dairy in San Bernardino County. The hearing will begin with a presentation from Water Board staff. Next, we will hear comments from the public. Then there will be a designated time for the board to ask questions. All people who wish to comment in the hearing remotely should already be in the Zoom meeting. If you have not registered or submitted an orange speaker card, you are requested to do so now. All people who expect to testify, please stand and raise your right hand and take the following oath. Do you swear to take the testimony you are about to give is the truth? If so, answer, I do. When it is your turn to speak, please state your name and affiliation and whether you have taken the oath before testifying. We will now hear the staff presentation by John Morales.
Good morning, Madam Chair, board members, stakeholders, and ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Morales, and I'm a water resources control engineer in your Victorville office. I will present our proposed revised individual waste discharge requirements, known as WDRs, for the active Desert Oasis Dairy located in Barstow within our South Lahontan region. Next slide. My presentation that follows will address these six main categories: facts about dairy cows and wastewater flow in the dairy, our dairy strategy, location, and history of the Desert Oasis Dairy. How the proposed individual WDRs will protect water quality. Comments and issues received from stakeholders. The last slide will provide a recommendation to the board. Next slide. Facts about dairy cows. This slide shows a perspective to fully appreciate nutrients and wastewater from dairy facilities in general. Equivalent cow waste. The average dairy cow produces about 120 pounds of manure and 3.5 gallons of urine per day. This equates to about 21.9 tons per year for each cow. A 2,000 cow dairy generates more than 240,000 pounds of manure daily, or nearly 90 million pounds a year. Such waste contains a portion of nitrogen or nutrients that can harm water quality. For total nitrogen, an average cow generates 164 pounds of nitrogen per year, while a human being only generates 9 pounds of nitrogen per year. This difference yields a 1 to 18 ratio between a cow and a human being on a per pound and yearly basis. Next slide. The Great Dairy Cycle. The flow path of wash water and storm water in the dairy process is as follows. Beginning with the top picture at the 12 o'clock location and traversing in a clockwise rotation. Liquid manure consisting of urine and feces from the animals is generated in the corrals. Wash water is generated as the cows get their udders clean prior to entering the milking parlor. The wash water is blended with urine and feces during the udder cleaning process. Wash water is further generated at the milking parlor. The wash water that is generated flows by gravity to a concrete-lined wet well, where it is collected and stored until the demand for use arises. The wash water is spray irrigated at the crop fields. Storm water mixed with wastewater from the corral is directed to storm water impoundments. Next slide. We propose to regulate the Desert Oasis Dairy through a revised individual order, since the dairy is currently regulated under Board Order Number 6-96-09. This tailor-made waste discharge requirement will allow us to focus better on specific needs of the dairy and thus address any issues more appropriately. We have worked more collaboratively with the dairymen on every stage leading to the completion of this proposed board order. This individual order is the first order to come before the board following the presentation of our dairy strategy in April of 2024. The objective of groundwater monitoring is to evaluate and assess the effectiveness of best management practices, better known as BMPs, to ensure protection of water quality. Next slide. The facility is located on a 297-acre dairy site adjacent to and north of the Mojave River, approximately 3 miles west of the city of Barstow. The California map on the bottom right shows the location of a dairy marked with a red star. The facility consists of two separate dairies, dairy number one and dairy number two. The green boundaries shows the crop field boundaries, which are the only authorized disposal sites for dairy wash water and manure. Each dairy has a wet well, shown here with the orange dot, where the dairy wash water from the milking parlor collects. From the wet well, the dairy wash water is used to irrigate the crop fields using a big gun sprinkler system. Manure from the corrals is stockpiled in the corrals to dry and then used to fertilize the crop field. Three online stormwater ponds are located on the south side of the facility. Stormwater runoff from the corrals, including stormwater diversion around the corrals, is directed to the stormwater basin through a series of concrete line V ditches, underground conveyances to the ponds. The ponds are separated from the Mojave River by a San Bernardino County flood control berm. Three monitoring wells exist on site, namely MWF-1, MWF-2, and MWF-3, which are all located down gradient of the facility. Groundwater flow is generally to the east, parallel to the Mojave River. Next slide. History of the Desert Oasis Dairy. In 1981, the first individual WDR was issued to the facility. During the 1980s, the dairy underwent growth and changes in operation of the facility. The revised WDR in 1996 expanded the facility to include authorized discharges from dairy number two. In 2011, an investigative order was issued requiring that a nutrient management plan, an NMP, be submitted to the water board. In 2011, the facility was managed under new ownership. In 2021. This year, 2025, marks the adoption of a revised WDR, tailor-made for the specific needs of the Desert Oasis Dairy. Next slide. In the following slides, I will explain how the proposed order will protect water quality. Next slide. The proposed order requires the discharger to implement appropriate BMPs as source control to minimize the potential for waste discharge to adversely impact groundwater and the environment. Many common BMPs have specific design standards adopted by the Natural Resources Conservation Services, or better known as NRCS. The most common conservation practice standards that are applicable at the Desert Oasis Dairy are shown on this slide. These are NRCS Standard 355, groundwater testing, NRCS Standard 570, stormwater runoff control, NRCS Standard 590, nutrient management, and NRCS Standard 634, waste transfer. Next slide. The proposed order requires that the dairy wash water must be collected, transferred, and stored in the facility wet well for use on crop fields at agronomic rates. This slide shows dairy wash water applied at the cow udders as they are directed towards the milking parlor. The wash water flows to the floor drains that connect to an underground channel that leads into the wet well. Next slide. This slide shows a crop field at the Desert Oasis Dairy with specific sporadic ponding. The proposed order requires that dairy wash water must be applied at agronomic rates as specified by a California certified agronomist through an approved nutrient management plan. The proposed order also requires that the application of dairy wash water be applied in a manner to prevent runoff, minimize percolation to groundwater, and minimize ponding. The proposed order allows the discharger flexibility to determine the manner to comply with these requirements as long as performance criteria are met. This photo was taken at the time that the investigative order was issued to the discharger. The condition of the crop fields serve as evidence that the facility was indeed of a nutrient management plan to control ponding. For stormwater, the proposed order requires that BMPs be utilized to prevent stormwater runoff from crop fields and eliminate ponding on crop fields within 72 hours following a 25-year, 24-hour storm event. In Barstow, a 25-year, 24-hour storm event yielded approximately 2.1 inches of rain within a 24-hour period. Again, the proposed order the discharger flexibility to determine the manner to comply with these requirements as long as performance criteria are met. Next slide. The proposed order requires that the corrals and other manured access areas must be graded to ensure positive drainage of wastewater to the stormwater collection system located along the sides of the corrals and access areas. There must be no standing water in the corral 72 hours after a 25-year, 24-hour storm event, and diversion runoff must flow to the stormwater impoundment. Corrals must be compacted to minimize the infiltration of water into the underlying soils. The proposed order allows the discharger that flexibility to determine the manner to comply with these requirements as long as performance criteria are met. This slide shows an example of a well-maintained and adequately sloped and well-compacted corral at the Desert Oasis Dairy. Next slide. Manure management. Approximately 2,523 dry tons is generated per year at the Desert Oasis Dairy. Some of the dry manure is used as top dressing and fertilizer on crop fields. The remaining is sold and transported off-site. The proposed order requires that the manure stockpile be managed to minimize infiltration of water into the underlying soils. Dry manure that is stockpiled outside the corral must be maintained with BMPs to prevent runoff of manure-laden water during storm events. The proposed order also allows the discharger the flexibility to determine the manner to comply with these requirements as long as performance criteria are met. Next slide. The only authorized disposal site for stormwater generated within the corrals are the stormwater impoundments located on the south end of the facility, as shown in this slide. The average annual rainfall at the dairy is about 4 inches per year. So the stormwater impoundments receive little discharge, if any, most of the year. That said, this photo shows stormwater collected in the stormwater impoundment after a summer monsoon in 2023. Next slide. Some of the shelters in the corrals are equipped with rain gutters that direct stormwater directly into the stormwater collection system. It is important that shelters have rain gutters to prevent scouring as the stormwater cascades from the shelters onto the soil. Without any gutters, excessive scouring will occur and will promote ponding, as can be seen on this slide. The proposed order does not require rain gutters to be installed, but rather allows the discharger the flexibility to determine the manner to meet the performance criteria of positive drainage to the stormwater collection system, and no standing water in the corral 72 hours after the 25-year, 24-hour storm event. Next slide. The proposed order requires the discharger to propose and monitor a groundwater monitoring network to evaluate compliance with the order and to evaluate effectiveness of the source control DMPs. The groundwater monitoring network must be designed to monitor the water quality at the top of the water table, up gradient and down gradient of the facility. The proposed order requires that a minimum of 3 groundwater monitoring wells, 1 up gradient and 2 down gradient, be available for proper and accurate monitoring of groundwater quality. Next slide. The proposed order requires that the discharger submit the following reports and plans. Within 90 days of order adoption, the discharger is required to submit a groundwater monitoring well network plan designed to adequately monitor water quality up gradient and down gradient of the facility. Within 6 months of board order adoption, an updated nutrient management plan must be submitted. Implementation of the NMP is intended to control discharges, minimize odors and nuisance conditions, and prevent groundwater degradation and or pollution. No later than 90 days following the adoption of the order, the discharger must submit a revised sampling and analysis plan called the SAP, including procedures for sampling and analysis of wash water, groundwater, manure, tissue, and soils at the crop fields. The procedures included in the SAP must be in accordance with the approved NMP. The monitoring and reporting program requires the middle of reports to document monitoring of manure, dairy wash water, supply water, storm water, crop field soils, plant tissues, groundwater, and general facility operations and maintenance. The annual report must also include a summary of the results of implementing the NMP, including a summary of the nutrient balance and recommendation for changes in nutrient management based on site-specific criteria. Next slide. The tentative order was released for public comment, and staff received 7 comment letters back. All comments were addressed separately placing the response to comments in a tabular format, which is included as enclosure 2 in the agenda package for your use and reference, beginning on bait stamp page number 5-53. The following slides represent the most commonly made comments from stakeholders and how board staff responded. Next slide. This is comment number 6, found in bait stamp page number 5-60. On the right is the comment, and on the left is the board staff response. The commenter requested that the order require that no standing water occur in crop fields unless after a measurable storm event. It is unreasonable to require no standing water or ponding in the crop fields. Storms happen and irrigation lines break. We don't want to set a requirement that the discharger cannot meet. We do think it is reasonable to allow the discharger the flexibility to determine the manner in which they intend to meet the performance criteria. For spray irrigation of dairy wash water on crop field, the performance criteria are to minimize ponding, prevent runoff, and minimize percolation to groundwater. We revised board order requirements to require this criteria on the crop field. For storm water on the crop fields, the proposed board order was revised to prevent runoff and eliminate ponding of stormwater within 72 hours following the storm event. Next slide. Comment number 12, found on bait stamp page number 5-64, relates to the herd size and the trigger of a material change that requires the submittal of a revised report of waste discharge. The commenter requested that the criteria triggering a material change based on the design capacity of the herd size at the facility and not the herd size when the board order gets adopted. We recognize that the herd size fluctuates. That's based on operational and economic needs, and therefore agreed that the proposed change was appropriate. The order describes the design capacity of the dairy and defines the material change as an increase in herd size above the design capacity. Next slide. Comment number 27, found on bait stamp page number 5-73. The commenter recommends and requests that the WDRs should allow the nutrient management plan specialist, which is a certified agronomist, to be the responsible party to decide on the sampling frequency for each field to accommodate the specifics of each area. Staff agreed that the agronomist be the one to specify the frequency and the need to soil sample each crop field. The proposed order was changed accordingly. Next slide. So this is a late change to requirement 6.A.1. Staff recommend a late change to board order requirement 6.A.1 on bait stamp 5-24 in your agenda packet. The late change is related to the due date for submitting the groundwater monitoring well network work plan. Currently, the proposed order requires that the work plan is due no later than 90 days following the adoption of the order. We propose to change the due date to be no later than 180 days following adoption of the order. We feel that this extra time is a good idea because it will give the discharger more time to comply and develop a better plan. The discharger is in support of this change. Next slide. This is the end of my presentation. We have addressed all of the comments submitted by stakeholders and consultants on the tentative order. We feel confident that the proposed order will protect groundwater quality and the environment. And as such, my recommendation to the board is to adopt the proposed and revised waste discharge requirements for the Desert Oasis Dairy. Next slide. I would like to thank you all for your attentiveness, and I hope that my presentation has been informational enough so that you may comfortably adopt this proposed order for the Desert Oasis Dairy. At this time, I will entertain any questions that you may have.
Board Chair? This is Elizabeth. Could I add a clarification?
Sure.
John Morales's recommendation slide suggested that we adopt the order with the changes presented. He didn't say that out loud, but I just wanted to clarify that that is the recommendation of staff. Include the changes presented in the PowerPoint.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. We'll now allow for public comment. Toby Moore, please state your name and affiliation and whether you've taken the oath before testifying.
Yes, good morning. My name is Toby Moore. I'm the Water Resource Manager, Chief Hydrogeologist for Golden State Water Company. And I did take the oath prior to testifying today. Golden State did provide comments, as Don has indicated, to this order. Golden State provides water to the city of Barstow. We have a very large well field, the Bradshaw well field, where we currently have 11 active high capacity production wells just down gradient of this facility. This well field has been impacted by nitrate beginning in 2017. Approximately 5 of our production wells were impacted over the maximum contamination level of 10 milligrams per liter of nitrate. We have, as a result, installed a nitrate treatment facility, multi-million dollar effort that treats only 3 of those wells at any particular time. So if those demands or impacts of nitrate increases, we'll have to essentially expand that facility. We're very concerned about any sources of nitrogen of gradient. We have been working with staff, and we appreciate all the effort that staff has provided in discussions with Golden State regarding this order. We believe that this order addresses a number of the issues that we've seen, including more expanded groundwater monitoring program, better best management practices, and the nutrient management plan. So with that, we do support the adoption of this order, and we thank you for your time. Thank you.
Ariel, are there any orange cards? Any more orange cards?
Yes, one for Jack Vanderholt. He's coming to the podium now.
Great.
Jack Vanderholt, I'm owner of Desert Oasis Dairy. I'd like to thank the staff for taking time to prepare this order and for taking consideration of our comments and the community comments as well. We feel like what we've done from the previous order has monitored the program, and this new proposed order takes that with additional measures to be a benefit to the community. And
Jack, sorry to interrupt. Can you please state your affiliation or whether you've taken the oath before testifying?
Jack Vanderholt, Desert Oasis Dairy, and I did take. So, what was that? And so the current order that we have with the monitoring program, this new order, is it's a and some additional steps to it, and we're committed to implementing that with the board's help and take on the economic challenge of doing so. And we appreciate the opportunity to talk. Thanks.
Ariel, was that the final orange card?
Yes, I have no more speaker cards.
Okay, thank you. Are there any final ones here? Jasmine?
I see no raised hands.
Okay, thank you. A couple of folks in the Zoom platform. So just give them a moment.
Okay. Yes, I do see two raised hands. I will start with Paul Sosa.
Okay. Paul, if you could please state your name, affiliation, and whether you've taken the oath before testifying.
Yes, my name is Paul Sosa. I'm with Western United Dairies, a statewide dairy producer trade association, and I did take the oath. Hope you can hear me.
Yes.
I would like to thank the staff for all of the work that they put into this order, multiple meetings. I worked with Jack, the dairy owner, in helping to coordinate with staff and get comments in on this. Staff listened to all the comments submitted and revised the order as appropriate. We are looking to extend the timeline to submit the ground monitoring work plan from 90 days to 180 days, as was discussed by staff in agreement with staff. I think this makes it more realistic to prepare a good work plan, which is in everyone's benefit to do so. As mentioned by staff in the presentation, the WDR requires management practices to protect water quality and monitoring to determine if those practices are protective of water quality. This includes sampling of manure and wash water, among other things, developing a nutrient management plan to protect water quality with respect to manure application to the cropland, stormwater management, reports to the water board, along with water board inspections, and ultimately monitoring wells to determine if all of this is working to protect water quality. So this is going to add management practices and costs to the dairy, but we just heard Jack and his commitment to the community and doing the best for the community. And so with that, I support staff's recommendation to adopt this order. Thank you.
If there are no more...
We have one more comment on Zoom from Jean-Pierre Cataviella.
And if you could please state whether you've taken the oath before testifying, that would be appreciated.
Yes, hi, good morning, Madam Chair, board members, and staff. My name is JP Cataviella, and I have taken the oath. I'm here today representing Dairy Cares, a statewide coalition of dairy associations, cooperatives, and companies formed in 2001 to promote environmental and economic sustainability for California's family-owned dairy farms. I've worked for that organization since its foundation, and that work has involved working with several of the California's regional boards, especially in the Central Valley, many county permitting agencies, regional air districts, and other government agencies. In my long experience with so many agencies, I would say the professionalism of your staff in creating this order was exceptional. We appreciate the time and effort that went into drafting the order, and their willingness to listen to, understand, and thoughtfully respond to the comments of all stakeholders. We believe the order they are presenting for your approval today addresses those concerns in a sensible, balanced way. Although this order places significant economic burdens on the dairy, the elements of the order represent a balanced and comprehensive approach to protecting water quality and monitoring the dairy's performance. Therefore, we support adoption of this permit as presented today, including the recommendation of the staff to allow 180 days for preparation of a water quality monitoring plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Well, with no more public comment, now we'll move to board questions. Board Member Deaver.
Hello. I wanted to compliment the staff working with the stakeholders. What an incredible good job you guys did. Seems like everybody's on board. So, job well done.
Thank you, Board Member Lux.
Yeah, I agree with Rick on that one. Job well done. I did have one question, a clarification on the groundwater monitoring network requirement. So John, this is probably John Morales probably step up on this one. What it appears to me is there's 180 days to submit a proposal to the board for consideration. That makes sense to me. That's an appropriate, I think, flexible approach for the dairy operator to do, and it makes sense because there could be some interesting creative ways of doing it. But then somewhere else you mentioned, and I will say I'm really pleased to see the upgradient groundwater monitoring requirement. Without that, you really don't know what you have. If all you have is what's down below, you don't really know the difference. So I think that's really good. My question, though, gets to, you also said three wells, one upgradient, two downgradient. And that to me doesn't strike as a new plan. That sounds like kind of a prescriptive. And so it feels like there's a little tension there between a prescriptive three wells and submit a plan that kind of works and we're going to review it. So just kind of explain that one to me. And then what happens if the staff determines well, you know, this plan really isn't doing it, and will the plan include a groundwater model? You know, give me a little bit more on what you're anticipating in the network and the plan.
Thank you for the question. I guess we are providing ample time for the discharger and the consultant to assess the existing monitoring well. We're giving them the opportunity to do that. So we are expecting some kind of assessment of the existing system, and whatever the results come out from that assessment, whether they're good or bad, by that I mean whether further or more or additional wells may be needed. If that would be the case, then as a minimum, we will require the requirement of one upgrading and two downgrading monitoring wells. If that answers the question.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of a wait and see. We'll see what their assessment is, or you'll see what their assessment is, and kind of go from there. Which I think is an appropriate approach. It just leaves it fairly open. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. Thanks. That's all I've got.
Board Member Cox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at the numerous questions that have been asked in the responses from staff, also the flexibility of staff to hear that community input. This tells me it was a very rigorous outreach process for this. Did you have any residents from the community participate in this conversation? You know, being Hinckley, there's a lot of sensitivity about groundwater contamination in the area.
We did expose the tentative order to the private residents. We did not receive any comments back from them. I'm thinking of that they were okay with what we presented tentatively.
Good, thank you. And just seeing Golden State's support for this and the future monitoring plan that's to come, it tells me that this was a very, very collaborative process. So thank you for all the work by staff.
Board Member Pierce.
I just have a couple quick questions, and mainly just for my own interest. Was there an assessment done of what the monitoring quality or the water quality monitoring program will cost per year for the producer?
Thank you for the question. We have not dealt with the economic analysis on the side of the additional cost that it may incur for additional sampling. We are now at the stage of just presenting what needs to be done, and the economic analysis will come later.
Okay, thank you. And then I have one other question. On the list of the approved specialists who could do the management plan, there's, you know, all the different certifications and the TSPs for NRCS. I was curious why NRCS staff that are certified planners with job approval authority with the 590 nutrient management plan aren't included in that.
Thank you for the question. The certified agronomist, my understanding is that it is a broad umbrella that covers or should cover a variety of professionals, including NRCS standards and professionals and recommendations. So when I mentioned the certified agronomist, I am covering, I'm hoping that I'm covering that broad umbrella.
So having worked for NRCS, a lot of times the NRCS staff won't have those certifications because they have to pay for those themselves. So NRCS has an internal program, which is job approval authority by practice. So it might, I don't know if you can add that at this point or not, because most of those other certifications are going to be held by consultants that cost. And if they could work with NRCS staff that were certified with those within the, or had the job approval authority, that could be a less costly approach. That's it. Thank you.
Board Member Horn.
I'm just wondering if that, I mean, that sounds like a good suggestion. I'm wondering if that, it might be worth making another amendment to this order to clarify that.
Hi, this is Elizabeth. Stephan Victorville, could you clarify if the language in the order about technical service providers certified in nutrient management in California by the NRCS would cover the situation of Board Member Pierce?
No, I can tell you it doesn't. Technical service providers with NRCS are people outside of NRCS that have been approved with NRCS standards and practices.
Rob, how might you reword it?
I would just add NRCS certified planner with job approval authority in 590 nutrient management plan. Just add that to the list.
I propose we add those words to the order.
Pierce, could you repeat that?
Sorry.
A little bit slower, please.
Yeah, I know. I speak too fast. NRCS certified planner with a job approval and 590 nutrient management plan. Got it? No. Where'd I lose you? Job approval authority in 590 nutrient management plan.
This is Elizabeth. Stephan Victorville, if you want to respond right now, or we could go through the questions and then take a 5-minute break so you guys can speak amongst yourselves before coming back with your any information you want to provide to the board members on this topic.
I guess we could have a 5-minute break and discuss.
Okay, thanks.
John, if the board members couldn't hear you here, but I believe you said that you would prefer a 5-minute break after the board member questions so that you can assess the suggestion by Board Member Pierce and come back with a recommendation.
Yes.
We'll resume at 5:14. Board Chair, if you could.
John, I have a question for you, and it's kind of a 30,000-foot question. So the Mojave Basin is a closed basin, meaning there is no outlet. So all pollutants discharged within the basin stay within the basin, unlike dairies in Region 5. As I say, this is a 30,000-foot question. And I'm just wondering, if the fact that this is, the difference between a closed and an open basin, the fact that the Mojave is a closed basin, does that require an extra level of care to protect water quality with dairies?
Thank you for the question. This is my opinion, but yes, I would say yes, it does, because of that fact and other facts possibly that could be included. But yes, that is definitely one thing that we stress to all of our dischargers. And when we write permits, definitely take into account that particular facet, if you will, to determine, you know, to know that it is a closed basin and it's a delicate basin. Every basin is delicate, but in particular, this one being closed, I would say that it takes an extra precautionary step.
Okay, thank you. So I just a couple of comments. I think you did a great job on this permit. I think this shows the benefit of developing these permits for individual dairies instead of the general dairy order that we were working on before. I really like that you responded to comments by emphasizing performance standards rather than prescribing method. The more often that the Water Board can use that approach, I think the better in general. And that you responded to comments, you were very reasonable in your response to comments. So I think you did an excellent job on this permit as reflected in the comments from all the other people, and that's what I have to say.
Board Member Lux?
Yeah, this is just a kind of a follow-up to the full case. Maybe I could wait at the end, but I'll just do it. And perhaps it's for Ben more than as much as staff. So enclosure two, which were the responses and the comments and the responses, I really liked that. It reminded me of kind of an EIR, EIS format of response to comments. So I think it was great. But it's 45 pages long and pretty intense. And I kept getting lost as to who the commenter was, to be honest. I had to keep going back. Which letter am I reading here? Because after seven pages of the same letter. So this is a really dumb suggestion, but if we could have a header on every page that tells us who the commenter is, it would really help when something is this extensive. Sounds dumb, but I think it's easy in Excel. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, thanks.
John, I had one quick question. According to the study conducted by the Central Valley Dairy Representative Monitoring Program, it concluded that nitrogen loading contributions were approximately 94% from croplands, 4% from lagoons, and 2% from corrals. Are the proposed mandated expenditures distributed accordingly? And I know a lot of this is going to later be identified after the plan is drafted, but just off the top of your head.
If I understand correctly, Madam Chair, I guess you talk about expenditures or costs?
Correct.
We did take into consideration that study. To be honest, initially we were requesting, or we were looking at lining or talking with the discharger about lining the existing impoundment, stormwater impoundment, that is. But because of that study, that only 4% of degradation occurs at the stormwater impoundments and a small percentage in the corrals, most of it, like you mentioned, is occurring at the crop field. So because of that, we decided not to require the lining of these impoundments. So as far as expenditures, I think we are promoting the saving of money to the discharger in that regard.
Thank you. Before I close the hearing, are there any final questions by the board or the public? Ariel?
No.
Great. Board Chair, I would suggest not closing the hearing quite yet because staff could come back with some information regarding Board Member Pierce's suggestion. So maybe after we conclude the short break for them to discuss, we could close the hearing at that time. It's 11:15. We'll resume at 11:20 a.m.
Jan Zimmerman, supervising engineering geologist with the Victorville office, and I have taken the oath. Can we have AGP pull up slide 22, please? Next slide. Sorry. Slide 23. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. I really appreciate, I'm going to get on the soapbox. Thank you, everyone, for showing up. And this really was a collaborative endeavor on our part. And we wanted to put a good faith effort forward. This is the first order to be adopted following our dairy strategy. And I think the team did a fantastic job. So thank you, everybody. So our recommendation here is to adopt the revised WDRs for the Desert Oasis Dairy with the change presented, with the late change for submitting the groundwater monitoring network plan 180 days after adoption. Also, to address Board Member Pierce's comment, we propose the following late changes be made to the order. On base stamp 5-22, Section 4A4, we propose to add NRCS certified planner with job approval authority in NRCS standard 590 nutrient management plan as a certified person to prepare the nutrient management plan. We propose to make that same change to base stamp 5-27, attachment B, under nutrient management principles, and make that same change to base stamp 5-30 under statement of certification, section 7-7.A. So with those late changes proposed, we recommend that the board adopt the order. Thank you.
Before I close the hearing, are there any final questions by the public or board members? Hearing none, I will close the hearing. And we will now engage in board deliberation followed by a vote. Board Member Deaver.
I'm good with it.
Great. Okay. Board Member Lux.
Aye.
I think they're just going to deliberate. Yeah, I think there's going to be some confusion.
I'm sorry. I would like to say, I want to tell you that I think it's all been said. Great work by staff. I love the collaborative approach, and I'm change is fine with me. I'm ready to go.
At this point, would you like me to go down the list of all the board members, or should somebody make a motion?
I do have a comment.
Okay.
If you're not ready.
Okay, board member call.
Going back to one of Mike's metaphors, this is sausage making at the best, carrying on with the collaborative process that has been established and now allowing the board to weigh in on this and adding, I think, another dimension that makes this even a better order. And with that, I would be delighted to make the motion on this.
Board Member Cox, in your motion, can you state whether or not you would like the order to be approved with the changes presented by staff?
Yes, my motion includes the changes that staff has proposed on the 180 days, as well as the language that was added to include the NRCS staff members.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you.
We'll now take a vote. Board Member
Board Member Mustafavi, there might be other board members who'd like to comment before the vote. Board Member Pierce.
I have none. Again, just to congratulate everybody on a job well done.
Board Member Horn.
I have no further comments.
May I now make a vote or take a vote? If anybody would like to make a second the motion, that is a possibility, though it's not required. It's just been customary. So if you would like to continue that practice, you could see if anybody would like to second the motion.
I second the motion.
Okay. And now we can go on to a vote. Thank you.
Okay, great. Board Member Deaver.
Aye.
Board Member Lux.
Aye.
Board Member Cox.
Aye.
Board Member Pierce.
Aye.
Board Member Horn.
Aye.
And I vote aye as well. Next, we turn to item 6, Lake Tahoe Marina General NPDES Permit Informational Update. We will now hear a staff presentation by Brian Judge.
So this forward slides. Okay, good morning, almost afternoon, Board Chair Mustafavi, board members, friends, and colleagues. I'm Brian Judge, engineering geologist in the Nonpoint Source Unit here at the Water Board. I'm here to present an information item on the Lake Tahoe Marina General Permit, National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, NPDES, and Waste Discharge Requirements, WDRs. Item number 6 at bait stamp 6-1 of your packet. On slide 2, here's the outline of the presentation. I'll go over the purpose of the presentation, so the 11 marinas under the permit, go over the current permit status and the current permit summary, outline specific water quality monitoring and protection plans tailored to each marina, show some marina BMPs, talk about the development of the future permit, and the next steps. The presentation purpose is to provide an overview of the current marina general permit and areas of possible modification, and to share feedback and suggestions on how to improve the permit for water quality protection, user friendliness, clarity of the permit, and efficiency. So this map shows the 11 marinas enrolled in the current permit. All the marinas have unique characteristics specific to each marina. They all have some things in common and some not. Therefore, operations, monitoring, and reporting are different at each marina depending on those factors. So all the marinas moor and sur boats. They all sell fuel, have spill response kits, have trained staff on aquatic invasive species, AIS. I'll be using these acronyms later. Identification, AIS identification, spill response, and good housekeeping. They perform annual AIS surveys, perform water quality monitoring, and submit annual reports. Some of the differences are some have enclosed harbors, some have buoy fields, some have both. Some have sewage pump-out facilities, some have discharge to surface water, most don't. And two have active streams running through. And I'm going to briefly show each marina from a Google Earth view to further demonstrate the variety of marinas. First one is Lakeside Marina, standing on the south shore. Lakeside Marina has an enclosed harbor, and they don't own the parking lot, so no required stormwater BMPs from the parking lot. Next is Ski Run Marina. It has a harbor and a buoy field, enclosed harbor, and it's mostly a big tour boat marina with small boat rentals too. So they pump a lot of sewage due to the large tour boats there. Bijou Park Creek empties into the south end of this marina. Timber Cove Marina has an open water pier and a buoy field, and they don't own the parking lot, so they're not responsible for stormwater BMPs for them. Tahoe Keys Marina is the biggest marina at Lake Tahoe and is a full-service marina with gasoline, diesel, sewage pump outs, boat cleaning, boat repairs, etc.
This marina is in the process of a full redevelopment over the next several years. This one is Camp Richardson. It has a pier and a buoy field, non-closed harbor, and plus it has a stormwater treatment system for the parking lot. So I'm moving up to the West Shore. All the West Shore marinas are similar. They all have an enclosed harbor and a buoy field, and this one is Obexer. Next is Homewood High and Dry. They call it High and Dry because all the boats are stored in that big building on the left and on outdoor racks. And upon a customer's request, they launch the boats and place it on a buoy. Here's Sunnyside. One difference is that much of the industrial activities happen on the other side of the highway, away from the lake. Industrial activities at a marina are things like boat repair, handling potentially hazardous materials, and boat washing. This is the first North Shore marina. It's the Tahoe City Marina. It has a fully enclosed harbor, buoy field, and all services. Sierra Boat Company has an enclosed harbor, buoy field, and all services. And virtually all the industrial activities occur in the large building on the right side of the pool. The last marina is North Tahoe Marina, and it has an enclosed harbor, buoy field, and all services. Okay. The current permit was issued in 2016, and this MPDS permit regulates point source pollutants from stormwater associated with industrial activities. It sets discharge limits and requires monitoring and reporting. In general, federal regulations require stormwater discharges associated with specific categories of industrial activities to be covered under MPDS permits, including in this case, industrial activities and marinas. The permit expired in 2021. However, all dischargers submitted a report of waste discharge prior to expiration. Therefore, the terms and conditions of the expired permit are administratively continued pending issuance of a new permit. All facilities under the permit maintain coverage until the permit is reissued. Discharges covered under include runoff from rainfall and snowmelt that comes in contact with activities in marina parking lots, boat maintenance areas, boat cleaning areas, docks, and fueling stations that can pick up pollutants and transport them. Common pollutants in this type of runoff include oil and grease, heavy metals, sediment, nutrients, and bacteria from sewage handling. So here's the permit summary. The permit applies to marina owners, operators at Lake Tahoe. Discharges regulated by the permit are industrial stormwater from marina operations, construction stormwater from construction activities at marina facilities that disturb less than 1 acre of land, and authorized non-stormwater discharge. Effluent limitations and water quality compliance. It requires compliance with numeric and narrative effluent limitations of pollutants and stormwater discharges, and specifies benchmarks for nitrogen, phosphorus, turbidity, oil, grease, and heavy metals. The permit prohibits certain waste discharges into surface waters, including boat washing wastewater, pressure washing runoff, and certain hazardous substances. EMPs, we all know EMPs, all right? Best management practices. The permit requires implementation of stormwater BMPs to minimize pollution. It includes site-specific, tailored to each marina, stormwater pollution prevention plans, and marina pollution prevention plans. Monitoring and reporting includes monthly visual inspections, annual comprehensive site inspection, or stormwater discharge inspections and sampling. The sampling includes effluent sampling, and those are discharges from the land to surface water of the lake, and regular surface water monitoring, that's sampling within the marina, the water body itself. The permit requires regular water quality monitoring, reporting of discharges, maintenance of compliance records, and submittal of an annual report. Okay. This permit requires preparation and submittal of stormwater pollution prevention plans and marina pollution prevention plans tailored to each marina. As seen in the Google Earth views, the layout, drainage, and uses vary amongst the marinas. The purpose of the stormwater pollution prevention plans is to
pollutants from being carried away by stormwater runoff. The requirements include identification of potential pollutants and sources, establish BMPs, perform inspections, monitoring, and corrective actions, plan for spill prevention and response, and specifies stormwater sampling and reporting requirements. The other plan required are marina pollution prevention plans. Their purpose is to minimize pollution from marina-specific operations like fueling, sewage disposal, boat cleaning, and maintenance. The requirements include BMPs for fueling, sewage pump out, and boat maintenance areas, guidelines for boat cleaning, procedures for waste disposal like oil, antifreeze, solvents, things like that, and implementation of spill containment measures. Let's see, the next three slides I'm going to show photos that were taken during some of the many inspections staff perform of marinas. The photo on the left shows proper storage of hazardous material with secondary spill containment basins below each barrel. The second photo is a steel shed that contains hazardous materials in barrels. In this case, the shed has a reservoir built into the base to contain spills. The two photos on the right show spill response materials such as oil absorbent booms and pads. These are at every marina and are spread throughout the properties. Next, the photo on the upper left shows a well-maintained and clean shop area. There's no visible oil stains and it's a well-organized work area. The next photo shows a sewage pump out facility, and that's typical for marinas. They don't all have. The third is a fuel pump with a green box below. That box below the fuel pump has a fuel detection system with an alarm and it's sort of a reservoir. So every junction in the fuel system has a box with a leak detection and all the pipes are double walled. The photo on the right shows a staff member fueling a boat. Staff at all the marinas are trained at safe fueling procedures. Only staff are allowed to fuel boats. Always wrap the dispenser with an oil absorbent pad to catch any drops. More photos. Marinas have installed stormwater treatment BMPs to prevent contaminants from flowing to surface waters during storm events or spring smooth. The left photo shows an infiltration base with an elevated drop inlet. The entire boatyard at the Tall Keys Marina drains to this basin, and when this gets full, it overflows into the drop inlet and discharges directly to the marina. The center photo shows an infiltration treatment basin at the Camp Richardson Marina, and all the parking lots run off drains to this basin, so none of it gets to the marina. The last photo shows a slotted drain, and what it does not show is a large infiltration chamber under the concrete slab, so none of this stormwater gets to. So I'm going to pause here in a little bit. You might ask, is this permit functioning as intended and does it protect water quality? Generally, staff believe the marinas are successfully complying with the permit and it is effective. There are many inspections, monitoring, and reporting to the water board required, and that we believe keeps the permits on track. The current permit has been in effect for over 8 years, and some changes in technology, practices, and lake ecology warrant an update. To start the process of the future permit, we emailed an electronic survey and questionnaire and met with key stakeholders, including the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, the Tahoe Resource Conservation District, all the marina operators and owners, the League to Save Lake Tahoe, and consultants who manage monitoring and reporting for the marinas. We received valuable feedback, some incorporated into the list on the screen, and staff agree with the suggestions. First one is SMARTS. I don't know what that is, but California uses several databases to track permits. One is SMARTS, and the one we currently use for this particular permit is CWICS. With CWICS, all reports are emailed to staff, and staff uploads the information to the database. The suggestion is to use SMARTS instead. With SMARTS, the permittee uploads all reports and is more user-friendly. Second one is fillable forms. There's seven forms the permit is required to complete and submit throughout the permit cycle. One form, the annual report form, has 10 separate sections. A few of the forms include things like weekly inspection form, monitoring reports, visual inspection of stormwater discharge, and the list goes on. One commenter suggested creating fillable PDFs and concise guidance and smarts for the permit update. This change would streamline reporting for the permittees and make review reports by water staff more. AIS surveys, that's aquatic invasive surveys, aquatic invasive species, sorry. The current permit has a requirement to complete a survey and map of AIS yearly. The TRPA, Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, has recently adopted a requirement for marinas to submit AIS marina management plans. Those plans require all marinas to perform a similar, way more detailed survey for AIS yearly than what we required. So we should go along with it since the afternoon anyway. This change can make the AIS survey requirement more consistent with TRPA required plan submittals and avoid redundancy for marine operators. Sample, timing, frequency, constituents. Currently, the permit requires effluent samples to be taken in the first 30 minutes of discharge. It's difficult for personnel to be at the location within such a short time, waiting for it to rain. One stakeholder suggested changing this requirement to at least 1 hour. Stakeholders also suggested looking at the feasibility of removing certain constituents from testing based on past results. And what is a closed marina? Stakeholders suggested that we clarify the meaning of closed marina during winter. Sampling is not required when the marina is closed. However, some marina parking lots are still in use for other activities like hotels and restaurants. And it's not, the definition isn't very clear. Let's see, next is voter education materials. Voter education materials regarding AAS and pollution prevention are required at marinas for their customers. Stakeholders suggest that Water Board partner with TRPA and environmental groups to provide standardized materials to all marinas. Last is a master table for required submittals. Currently, tables and deadlines are spread throughout the permit. They're scattered. Stakeholders suggest adding a master table containing all required submittals and associated due dates in one place. And so next steps. Next steps, continue to gather stakeholder feedback. Some of the responses in the survey were very detailed, and a more thorough discussion may be helpful for us. Look for streamline opportunities. Staff would like to look at opportunities for organizing and streamlining the permit. Review annual reports. Staff would like to take a more detailed look at the sampling results and required permitting inspections and record keeping to weigh the possibility of adjusting some requirements. And the plan is release a tentative permit for public comment in the spring summer of 2026. For a 30-day public comment period, and bring the proposed permit to this board for consideration by October 2026. That concludes the presentation. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian. We'll now allow for public comment. Jasmine or Ariel?
I have no public comment.
Thank you. Board questions. Board Member Devers.
No questions.
Thank you. Board Member Lex.
Just a couple. Thanks for that, Brian. Great photos. I'll be waiting for our boat tour of all these marinas anxiously. One question, when I saw the map of the lake, the aerial of the lake, it just, maybe it's the obvious question. So how much communication with whomever it is that does water quality in Nevada do we have? And there's marinas over there. Do they do it the same way? Are the BMPs similar? What's the connection there with the Nevada process?
GRPA regulates the marinas on the right side. They consider only two marinas on the Nevada side, Round Pines and Zephyr Cove Marina. And there's similar water quality requirements. As far as industrial stormwater, I'm not familiar with that part of it, that sort of lake, but in general, the TRPA regulates the number of moorings on the lake in total. So if there's a buoy on the lake, it's registered, or a slip in a marina, it's registered no matter which side of the lake it's on. So that's about.
Okay. And then this is more a curiosity one, but of the marinas that you're with, the 11, which one's most recent? In other words, when has the last marina been put in Tahoe?
I believe Tahoe City expanded their marina. I'm in a time warp since COVID, but probably maybe 7 years ago. They expanded quite a bit. The rest, pretty static. I don't know if Tahoe Marina has a plan. Their marina offshore and relocated. And I know the Tahoe Keys Marina is in a big redevelopment stage.
Okay, and one last one. So after winter, big snow, what specific or special cleanup stuff happens, you know, with the first melting? I mean, I'm pretty familiar with what Town of Truckee does with its roads and bike paths and stuff in that first, you know, 3-4 weeks. What goes on at the marina?
I mean, it's like any business in town. A lot of the marinas, their parking lots all winter long, so they're updating it. Some don't, and so they, I'm sure they sweep it and inspect BMPs. And so the marina permit requires inspection of BMPs periodically. I don't know that off the top of my head what the periods are, but you know, they're all required to update their BAPs, make sure they're functioning and maintain them, and they keep records.
Okay, just a suggestion maybe as you're working through this, it seems to me that initial inspection or that initial, you know, period after snowmelt is so critical because there's just so much junk that, you know, kind of piles up over the winter and just sits there. That might be a good time to require, you know, make sure the inspection's happening then rather than, you know, wait a month and, oops, some of that stuff slipped away from us.
They are required to they do a weekly visual inspection where they walk the marina every single week it's open and to keep records of that in notebooks. And so when we show up for an inspection, they expect us to look through their notebook and make sure that they've done their weekly inspections and filled out their weekly inspection reports, and that would show up.
Board Member Cox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian, this is a really interesting presentation, and I love the photos. Could we go to photo 6, slide 6?
Okay, ski run.
Mm-hmm. So what is the darker imaging? You see it on probably 3 of these marinas. Is that organic matter? Is that growth?
That's the channel. So this is a shallow shelf to get out to deep water. So some of the marinas have to dig a channel out their marina to get out to the deeper shelf. And so the Water Board issues dredging permits in the 401 program for marinas to dig out their channels once in a while because they fill with silt in time.
Okay, and then could you go to slide 8, the Tahoe Keys?
Oh, I can do that. Then I have my thing up.
So same situation there at the, what we're seeing at the top, that's actually a dredging that has occurred. Okay, very, very interesting. This just really gives such a great perspective of the different types of marinas. I did have a couple of questions. Is there a BMP for a fuel spill? Is there some kind of an agent that could be cast on the water or something to absorb that? Can you educate me a little bit on that potential cleanup?
Yes. So each marina has a spill kit. I showed a photo in the first set of photos, and if there's a spill like that, or sometimes boats will just sink in their slip for some reason. And they're long booms, like a big tube that's, you know, 50 feet long, and they surround the boat with those types of booms. So oil and gas floats on top of water, and so those booms are meant to absorb those materials, and they don't absorb water, so it's, they selectively absorb those types of contaminants.
Interesting. Maybe when we do a tour, you could show us what those look like. Thank you. That's all I had.
Board Member Pierce?
No questions, but thanks for a great presentation.
Board Member Horn?
Thanks, Brian. So are the marina discharges of nitrogen, phosphorus, and fine sediment included in the Tahoe Team DL?
That's an interesting question. Those are constituents in the TMDL, not necessarily turbidity. For the TMDL, it's sediments. They're not sediments. Particles under 16 microns diameter, phosphorus and nitrogen. So they're not specifically called out in each marina. It's if the marina is within a jurisdiction, say under the municipal stormwater permit in Placer County, Lorona County, or the city at South Lake Tahoe, they have to reduce its constituents within the urban areas of their entire county, which a marina land is part of that overall reduction.
Thank you. What are the sources of copper, zinc, and lead in the stormwater?
That's another good question. I know in the past, a lot of boat paint materials were copper-based for like anti-fouling and things like that. And so I know that was a big source of copper. And I'm not sure about the other two. I mean, yeah, just there's a lot of metals and industrial.
Operations with the boating, and those are why they're specifically the US EPA benchmark pollutants that are identified in the marina permit and required for monitoring when stormwater is monitored. They do the nutrients, but also these base metals are included as well, because they're ones that would typically be found in a marina transportation industrial operation.
Same with auto shops.
Yeah, I mean, from past experience, I don't know if this is still true, that tires had heavy metals in them. And so it's just like runoff off roads. Stormwater can contain these heavy metals. So maybe the parking lots are contributing some of that too. I don't know. Okay, you mentioned, so one comment was about whether they should test samples before or after they entered treatment systems. I'm wondering what the pros and cons of either one would be.
Yeah, well, it's a specific comment related probably to the Tahoe Keys Marina. The consultants, one of the problems with the Tahoe Keys Marina is it goes through that basin I showed you, and the outlet into the lake is oftentimes underwater when the lake is high, so it's impossible to sample that water after treatment. So they've been sampling it before it goes through the treatment system and getting hits and exceeding the standards. So, you know, naturally, we all think sampling should be occur after it's gone through the treatment system before it discharges to the surface water. And so the Keys, there was another spot where they were sampling it straight from the parking lot before it went into their underground infiltration. It didn't make sense. So that should be clarified in the future of that type of sample.
Interesting problem. What are the changes in lake ecology that you're taking into consideration in this new permit?
Lake ecology, I think, well, the biggest, most obvious is aquatic invasive species and control. Some marinas have a lot, some have none.
Okay. And then just a couple of suggestions. I'm wondering, okay, just a different way of approaching the closed-in winter issue. it occurs to me that more flexibility would be added rather than defining what closed in winter is, saying what activities are required depending on, I'm going to use the word activities twice here, what regulatory activities, meaning what actions, BMPs, et cetera, are required depending on what human activities are occurring at the marina at the time. So it's a mix and match sort of thing rather than sweating over what the definition would be. Just a thought for your consideration. And then another thought for your consideration, which is the educational materials. You know, we've moved into an era when everybody's walking around with one of these. And I'm just wondering if there's a consortium of marinas that might be interested in developing apps with that? Or, I mean, who might? But figuring out a way to get that information easily accessible on phones might effectively get the word out. Just a thought, another thought for your consideration. That's it for me.
This concludes item 6. Thank you very much. Or we went through the questions. Okay, we're good. So we'll now break for lunch. The board members are here in Tahoe. We'll be meeting with staff for a lunch in the conference room in the main South Lake Tahoe office. The portion of the lunch where staff will provide an overview of their work will begin at 12:30. We'll resume the regular meeting of the board at 1:30 p.m. Thank you. Welcome back. We'll now move on to item 7, revision of the local agency management program, LAMP. The California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Manhattan Region, will consider adopting a resolution approving the revised local agency management program, LAMP, for San Bernardino County. The item will begin with a presentation from Water Board staff. Next, we will hear comments from the public. Then there will be a designated time for the board to ask questions. All people who wish to comment in this hearing remotely should already be in the Zoom meeting room. If you have not registered or submitted an orange speaker card, you are requested to do so now. We will now hear the staff presentation by Jose Valle de Leon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, board members, and members of the public. My name is Jose Valle de Leon. I am a water resource control engineer working in the Victorville office. I will be providing information on the proposed resolution, item number 7, for the revision of the San Bernardino County Local Agency Management Program, which may be referred to as the SB County LAMP. The initial goal of this presentation is to provide some background information on the State Water Board policy for on-site wastewater treatment systems, as well as some history regarding the SB County LAMP. The ultimate goal is for the board to approve this resolution. Next slide. As I mentioned, I'll be going over what a typical on-site wastewater treatment system, also known as OTS, looks like and how it works. We'll go over some key information regarding the tier system for the State Board OTS policy. For additional information, please refer to the green sheet in Bait Stamp 7-1. I will give a quick update on which counties and cities have existing LAMPs with the water boards. I will discuss some of the history and changes included within the revised SB County LAMP located in Bait Stamp 7-13. We will end with addressing any public comments received during the 45-day comment period, as well as staff recommendations. Next slide. The most common OTS is a typical conventional septic system with a leach field. It consists of a septic tank for initial treatment and a network of perforated pipes buried in the ground to distribute and filter wastewater, ultimately returning it to the soil. The septic tank is a buried watertight tank that receives wastewater from a home or building. Heavy solids settle to the bottom as sludge, while lighter solids and grease float to the top, called scum. The remaining liquid is the effluent, which is then discharged to the drain field. The drain field is an underground network of perforated pipes buried in trenches or a bed. The effluent from a septic tank flows through these pipes and into the soil. The soil acts as a natural filter, removing remaining pollutants and impurities. Treated wastewater then returns to the groundwater below the surface. Next slide. The State Board policy on us designed a tier system to categorize the on-site wastewater treatment systems. Tier zero consists of existing ponds that are properly functioning and do not meet the conditions of failing systems or otherwise require corrective action and are automatically included in the tier zero. Tier one are new or replacement ponds that meet low risk siting and design requirements as specified in the tier one policy. Where there is not an approved map. Tier three are new or replacement ponds within 600 feet of impaired water bodies listed in the OTS policy and must meet the specific requirements of tier three. Tier four consists of ponds that require corrective action or are either presently failing or fail at any time while this policy is in effect. For this presentation, tier two is the most relevant, which is what allows the formation of LAMPS. LAMPS approved under Tier 2 provide an alternate method from Tier 1 programs to achieve the same policy purpose, which is to protect water quality and public health and address local conditions. LAMPS may include standards that differ from the Tier 1 requirements for new and replacement ponds. For example, a LAMP may authorize different soil characteristics, usage of seepage fins, and different densities for new developments. Once the LAMP is approved, new and replacement pots that are included within the LAMP may be approved by the local agency. A local agency at its discretion may include Tier 1 standards within its Tier 2 LAMP for some or all of its jurisdiction. However, once a LAMP is approved, it shall supersede Tier 1 and all future OTS decisions will be governed by the Tier 2 LAMP until it is modified, withdrawn, or revoked. Next slide. As we discussed, Tier 2 of the State Board OTS policy allows for the formation and approval of LAMPS. LAMPS must include some basic requirements to protect water quality. On the slide, we have general components of what should be included in a LAMP. The agencies must outline design requirements for OTS, testing procedures for certain geological conditions, determine if there are impaired water bodies in the area, procedures to follow for failing OTS, and what individual reporting requirements for the residents. Local agencies must also report this information to the Regional Water Board on an annual basis by February of the following calendar year. Next slide. In the Lahontan region, we have 9 approved LAMPS and 2 Tier 1 agencies that are managed by our regional staff. Tier 1 follows the State Board OTS Policy Tier 1 standards. There are also 7 other LAMPS in the Lahontan region that are overseen by other neighboring regional water boards. The oldest LAMP in the region is for San Bernardino County, which was approved back in 2017. Since then, there have been 2 revisions to the State Board OTS policy, one in 2018 and the other in 2023. Each agency may choose to revise their LAMPS. There is no set timeline for each LAMP. All agencies must submit annual reports as well as a 5-year assessment report to see if changes or updates should be made for their individual LAMP. Doing so requires a great deal of collaboration with regional water board staff. Due to the large size of San Bernardino County, collaboration and review was conducted by 3 regional water boards: Region 6, Lahontan; Region 7, Colorado River Basin; and Region 8, the Santa Ana. Next slide. The first and current NSP County LAMP was approved by the Hunts Board in May of 2017. This LAMP covers all of the unincorporated areas and some small towns of San Bernardino County. The proposed resolution presented to you today is to approve the revision of the NSP County LAMP. Next slide. slide. For many years, California has been experiencing a rapid increase in home prices. The state has shifted focus on allowing for more affordable housing. This has led many residents creating ADUs, also known as accessory dwelling units, and JADUs, known as junior accessory dwelling units. Allowing homeowners to add more living spaces on their properties helps increase supply of affordable housing. An ADU is a secondary dwelling with complete independent living facilities for one or more persons. These types of units have several names, such as granny flats, in-laws units, backyard cottages, secondary units, and more. The current SB County LAMP in 2017 has very little guidance for ADUs. This has led to certain circumstances that were never covered in the LAMP, which required some guidance from the regional water boards. The current draft includes definitions, references, and some guidance on how to obtain septic tank permit with ADU additions. While requirements have not changed, language is much clearer and much easier to read. Most changes to the LAMP itself were made to improve clarity and to allow the reader to quickly find information needed. The addition of diagrams, photos, and tables also helps facilitate finding information. Next slide. The regional board did not receive any comments regarding this item within the 45-day comment period. Next slide. So staff recommends for adoption of the proposed resolution, R6 2025, proposed to approve the revision of the San Bernardino County LAMP. Next slide. I would like to thank my colleagues in Region 7 and 8 for their input on the LAMP revision. I would also like to acknowledge the hard work the County of San Bernardino and their staff in putting this LAMP together. And I thank you, board members and public, for your time and attention.
Thank you, Jose. We will now allow for public comment. Jasmine, are there any orange cards?
No.
Yeah. Okay. Ariel, other than Susan Beeson, do you have any orange cards?
No.
We will now listen to Susan Beeson.
Can the team confirm if Ms. Beeson wanted to speak or she was just on the line in case of any questions?
I'm online to if there are any questions for the Region 8 Santa Ana.
So Board Chair, I don't think that's a speaker card. It's just a water board staff from the Santa Ana region available to answer questions.
Good to know. Thank you. We'll now take board questions, followed by a vote. Board Member Deaver?
No questions.
Board Member Lux?
I've got a couple, they're all in the LAMP itself. I don't know if that's even fair game, but I assume it is because it's in our packet. So, and they're nothing special, just curiosity to some degree. But so on 7-41, it talks about slopes and disposal fields on slopes, and it notes maximum allowable is 45%. And I looked down the list here and it was from 5%. That seems, I mean, even though it obviously you have different design requirements as the slope gets steeper, that seems very steep to me. I don't know if that's a question or a I'm wondering if anyone has a sense, is that typical? Is that sort of a normal standard? Is that, or am I just not getting it?
This is the slopes that were in the previous LAMP as well. These have already been approved. This is just a continuation of that.
Okay, is that fairly typical? I mean, is that one in other places? I would think they would stop at about 30% or 35%. You wouldn't allow it after that. But anyway, okay, it was there. So, okay, second question, page 752, the alternative treatment systems. Can you just give me a couple examples? I think I know what that means, but I was looking for just a couple examples of what would that look like? What is an alternative? alternative treatment system in this context?
Yeah, so usually when the lot sizes are too small for the resident to install a septic system alone, they would install an alternative treatment system that would treat nutrient effluent and would bring it below the 50% removal rate. This is an extra step in the treatment process, usually done with an aeration, I guess, chamber within a typical septic system. So it's like a fourth chamber actually in that one. So it requires an extra effort, extra expenses, and also annual monitoring that they need to report to the county as well for that system.
Okay, so it's a little bit more technology and an engineered product, essentially another treatment step. Yeah, and my last question, I think it's my last question. Yeah, my last question on 760, it says the geographic areas for impaired water bodies, the 303D list areas that are called out, and there's five or six of them here, or seven or eight of them, and that just seemed like a very low number to me, given the hundreds and hundreds of 303D listed sites we have in the whole region. It felt like in this giant county, I'd see more of them. I'm assuming the answer is this is all that's all there is, but I'm just kind of curious about that.
So this is the Santa Ana region. This table here, because the LAMP incorporates all three regions, all issues with all three regions. This table here is just Santa Ana region. In San Bernardino County, for our region, there's not an impaired water body here that would fall in San Bernardino County. Maybe in the northern part of the La Junta, but not in San Bernardino County.
Okay. All right, maybe I wasn't reading this correctly. All right, thank you. That's all for me.
Board Member Cox?
No questions. Great presentation. Thank you.
Board Member Pierce?
No questions. Thank you.
Board Member Horn?
Well, you got practice on this question in board briefing. So this is a question I asked in board briefing, and I just thought other board members might enjoy hearing the answer. And that was a question pertaining to the third paragraph down on page Batestamp 7-4, where the language is, the county is committed to continue to send proposed OTS designs that do not meet specific LAMP criteria, and the county intends to also refer OTS that are engineered systems. So my question was, what happens if subsequently the La Junta learns that the county has not been complying with those commitments?
I guess the next step would be that the LAMP can be revoked from the county, which would require the board to issue waste discharge requirements for septic system. Other than that, I don't know.
Hello, this is Reginald Tan from the senior at the wastewater and agricultural unit. And yes, we have the choice, we have the ability to revoke the LAMP as appropriate, which after revoked, it will go back to tier one standard, which is the more stringent of the state water board owns policy. So there is an incentive for the county, which has been historically very collaborative with us of notifying us.
So it seems the county has an incentive to comply with those commitments.
There is, yes. So far, we haven't encountered any incident or reports that that says otherwise.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's my only question.
We will now take a vote. Is there a motion?
I'll move approval of the adoption of the revised OX policy or LAMP for San Bernardino County.
I'll second that motion.
Board Member Dieverick?
Aye.
Board Member Lux?
Aye.
Board Member Cox?
Aye.
Board Member Pierce?
Aye.
Board Member Horn?
Aye.
And I vote aye as well. We will now move on to the consent calendar and consider adopting the resolution for item 8, rescission of project approvals regarding Tahoe Keys Lagoon Aquatic Weed Control Methods Test. Is there anyone that wishes to comment on this item? Are there any? Sarah?
Just for the record, there is a commenter here in Tahoe who's going to speak on this, so we're removing it from the consent calendar, and you can go ahead and stick in your comment. Thank you.
Greetings, Chair and members of the board. My name is Sarah Bidra, and I am the interim executive director of the Tahoe Water Suppliers Association. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to provide written comment that is available in your board packet and to summarize our organization's comment on the rescission of the TKPOA CMT control methods test is what that stands for. And I will begin with the summary of, at this time, the TWSA sees the rescission of the project approvals as the proper course of action, as the primary outcome removed the regulatory roadmap of herbicide use in the ONRW Tier 3 waters of Lake Tahoe. The TWSA supports non-chemical methodologies as our members use the source water of Lake Tahoe to serve drinking water to their community. The mission of the Tahoe Water Suppliers Association is to develop, implement, and maintain an effective watershed control program. Part of this is advocating for the protection of Lake Tahoe as a viable source of drinking water. And to satisfy additional state requirements, including sanitary surveys and a watershed control program report, the use of herbicides in Lake Tahoe is in direct opposition of protecting Lake Tahoe as a viable source of drinking water. For this reason, the TWSA supports the proposed resolution to rescind the CMT project approval. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Sarah. Are there any board members that have questions for the commenter? Are there any other comment cards? Ariel?
No more comment cards.
Thank you. So we will now open it up for board deliberation and vote. Board Member Deaver?
I have no questions.
Board Member Lux?
No questions.
Board Member Cox?
No questions.
Board Member Pierce?
No questions.
Board Member Amy Horn?
I have no questions, and I move that we adopt this rescission of the controlled methods test.
Is there a second?
Second.
We'll now vote. Board Member Deaver?
Aye.
Board Member Lux?
Aye.
Board Member Cox?
Aye.
Board Member Pierce?
Aye.
Board Member Horn?
Aye.
And I vote aye as well. We will now turn to item 9, closed session, discussion of personal matters, consideration of the appointment, employment, or evaluation of performance about a public employee under the authority of Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision A. Board members in Tahoe will be walking over to the main South Lake Tahoe office to enter closed session. Rick will connect with you via teleconference. At the conclusion of this session, the meeting will be adjourned and the board will not be returning to open session. Thank you everyone for your participation in today's meeting.